distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, I present His Excellency, the Governor of the State of Wyoming, Dave Friedenthal.
Good morning, please. Thank you. Mr. President, Mr. Speaker, members of the 60th Legislature, and the citizens of Wyoming, I appreciate this opportunity to speak with you today. Yesterday, I came up through the back way to watch the administration of the oath of office in the House. Each time the session convenes, I either go to the Senate or the House to watch, because I think the oath of office is one of the most remarkable things in a representative democracy. There's that quintessential moment when the shallow seas of politics and elections recede, and suddenly the oath is administered. And before God and your fellow man, we all swear to uphold the Constitution, the state law of Wyoming, and implicitly acknowledge our responsibility to try to figure out what is the right thing to do. It's that point where we go from simply being in pursuit of votes to in pursuit of the right outcome for the state of Wyoming, recognizing that we are representative democracy and that we try to represent our constituents. We try to make sure we're representing the best angels of the spirit of our constituents. So I thank you for that opportunity. I congratulate all of you for being here. It is remarkable. Troubling and challenging time, not only in the United States, but in the world, and hence in Wyoming. In the last 6 months, we have watched the remarkable decline of the national economy, the state economy, individuals, corporations, and the people of the world. In that context, the world has lost nearly $30 trillion of wealth. The United States alone has lost $7 trillion of wealth, the greatest loss of wealth to occur in this country or this world at any time, including the Great Depression. This national recession is going on, and we are not immune. We have a false sense of immunity in Wyoming. The individuals don't, but the data suggests that there is. The individuals in this state, just like around the country, have watched their personal wealth decline, have watched their retirement plans be modified, are watching their children enter a job market that is far tighter than it has ever been. They're sitting patiently watching as we begin the decline of real estate values in Wyoming. This morning, in this morning's paper, as you saw, another set of layoffs in Wyoming. There have been layoffs throughout the state. And I believe that it is going to get much worse before it gets better. Wyoming has historically been a state that enters a recession late and exits a recession late. And that pattern is being repeated in Wyoming today. But as you know from talking to your constituents or looking at your own investment accounts, it is a very real issue in Wyoming, and it will continue to be that. Whether people are still employed or not, they're finding their hours cut, less overtime available. What used to be two-income households are now one-income households. And you can see it beginning to have its effect on governmental services. Medicaid numbers are beginning to rise. The traffic at the Department of Workforce Service Centers is probably double, at least anecdotally, is about double what it has been in the past, and we expect that to continue to rise. And so we arrive here today with a set of mixed messages. The data says we have the lowest unemployment rate in the country in November, and yet if you're the one who's unemployed, it's more than just a number. I was in a meeting the other day with a friend of mine, and at that point, she offered the observation that she'd gotten a call the night before from her child who had been laid off. Now, her son lived in a different part of the country, and yet the implications for her and for her budget and what she needed to do were severe. So as we stand here today, we need to understand that this is the beginning of a difficult period, not the end of a difficult period, and that we are not immune. And we face this uncertainty in the context of very mixed messages from the citizens. Not recently, there was a set of stories where it was acknowledged that the population in Wyoming had increased by 9,000 people. Off of a base of 523, we went to 532. The response to those stories absolutely amazed me. The response to those stories from a substantial part of the public was, what do we need these people for? Let's send them back. Where did they come from? They weren't born here. 9,000 people, a growth rate that this state had longed for decades. And when all of us campaigned, including me, everybody said, I want growth. I want things to happen in the state. And then all of a sudden, when it does, we find a body politic, a set of citizens who say, what is going on? What are these people doing here? Why are we trying to accommodate them? I would argue that in the context of representative democracy, that those are messages that we need not represent in our public life. They exist, but they should not be our guiding principle. As elected leaders, our responsibility is to make sure that growth continues, that growth occurs, and that we take care that the proceeds, the revenues from that growth, are properly invested in the economy. But it remains an issue in this state, and I encourage you to disregard that thought and to concentrate on what the future can be. The other change that's occurred, not just population, but the other change that's occurred to make our life more uncertain is this change in revenues. If you remember in July, when oil was $150, people were talking about a surplus, billion, billion two, billion five, huge numbers. So the interim committees are out working, putting together proposals that contemplate those kind of revenues. Dare I say, the agencies were creating budgets that contemplated those kinds of revenues. And then, when the revenues were finally projected in October, suddenly there was this drastic decline to $900 million. $900 million. At that point, I remained skeptical that $900 million was there. They projected the price of oil at $75. I wasn't confident of that and did not budget to that number, budgeted to what I thought was a safe number of $440 million. Well, in a matter of less than 3 weeks from the time I submitted my budget, it became clear that that was not a safe number. And so in January, we had a new set of budget projections of $259 million. $259 million when in July we thought we were looking at a billion or a billion and a half of revenue available. So we arrive here with a little unease with regard to the quality of the projections. We also arrive here in the context of having had a set of expectations that were built up not only within this body and within the executive branch of the government, but a set of expectations that were built up in the public and in the interest groups about what we were going to be able to fund and what we might be able to do. So each of you, much in the same position that I am, are telling people, no, we're not going to fund it. And they're saying, but in the summer, you said you thought you could. There's a real issue, I think, of getting people to understand that the expectations have changed so dramatically, not just for individuals, but also for the government. Many good ideas have fallen. They've been taken out of the budget. Many good ideas that have been offered by the interim committees will also fall. Individual proposals will fall. I early on supported and continue to support, but know that it won't happen. Just by chance, it happens to be in Thermopolis, but there was a Wyoming Bighorn Basin Nature and Discovery Center that they hoped to build. I remember being in my hometown and saying, you bet. This was early in the summer. I think there's revenue. We can take a look at that. And now I have to call my county commissioner friends and say, never mind, the world has changed. I suspect my circumstance is no different than yours. These ideas that we had and the hopes that we had are simply not going to come to fruition. And so we all enter into a state of grieving. And remember that the phases of grief are fairly well outlined, and just a couple of them are most applicable to us. First, there's shock and denial. Surely the Craig is wrong. Surely it's not correct. And eventually, we accept that it is correct. Then we move on to anger. And anger is probably the most difficult part, because we begin to look for somebody to blame, whether it's our fellow legislators or the legislative branch that I can blame or you can blame the executive branch. But we go through this process of saying, I may have to accept it, but I don't have to accept responsibility for it. And it's compounded by telling constituents no to things that 4 months ago we were saying yes to. This question about blame and anger is particularly dangerous in the context of politics. George Washington, in his farewell address in 1796, warned about the problems of factions and politics, that in fact is an incredibly dangerous thing. And I think in this country today, we would do well to heed his admonition. Washington observed the following: I have already intimated to you the dangers of parties in the state, and warn you in the most solemn manner against the baneful effects of the spirit of party generally. The common and continual mischiefs of the spirit of party are sufficient to make it the interest and duty of wise people to discourage and restrain it. Recognizing, as Washington did, that there is a role for politics, he also put some sideboards on it. He described politics and faction as a fire not to be quenched, but it does demand a uniform vigilance to prevent its bursting into flame, lest instead of warming, it should consume. Politics is a way that we organize the discourse. It cannot be a way that we control the discourse. And why do I bring it up? This is the first session for most of the people here in which we're actually going to have to make some really hard decisions about budgeting. Hard decisions that have to do with saying no in a way that we've never had to say it before. In prior years, we would say no, not this year, maybe next year. This year, we may be compelled to say no, and maybe not for a long time. The recourse, if it turns out to be that we choose to say it's the legislature's fault or the governor's fault or it's one party or the other part fault or it is one faction within a party's fault, we will end up with an incredibly unproductive session. So I hope that we can move quickly to the other stages of grief, which is working through it, and then acceptance and hope. But before we conclude that the sky is falling, let's just take a brief look back. The year I was first elected, in 03, the projected number for the price of oil was $18. The price of oil in these current projections, which we find so dismal, is 40. In 03, the projected price for natural gas was $2. Today, in these projections we're operating on, it's $3.75. And for coal in 03, it was $5.90. And in these projections, it's $11 and 6 cents. Now, these comparisons don't change the fact that we have less funding available than we thought we had. But bear in mind that we are still in remarkably good position relative to other states. So when I approached the budget, the supplemental budget, both my original recommendations and the second set of recommendations, I kept a couple of things in mind. One is the strategy that's been adopted over the last few years remains basically sound. We need to address the accumulated problems that arose in the state during the last several decades when there was no funding. Secondly, we set about an effort to invest in efforts to build Wyoming's future, whether it was on clean coal, whether it was building roads, or looking at schools. We invested in those, treated them as one-time expenditures, but invested in them. And the third principle was that we limited ongoing expenditures. If you look at the base budget for this biennium, there's an excess of $1 billion of one-time expenditures in that budget, $1 billion in the standard budget that we do not have to repeat if the economic circumstance continues. So we remain basically, I think, sound of course and need to move forward. Now, the second thing that guided me was that we are looking at these expenditures based on an incredibly substantial 2-year budget. It was a generous budget that was adopted last time. And so when people come to you and say, there's no money for my program, I would encourage you to look at the underlying budget before you accept that argument. A couple of illustrations. In the area of mental health and substance abuse, the funding has gone up 135% in the last few years. In the area of developmental disabilities, the funding has gone up 35%. And in the area of education, my calculator was insufficient to reach that number. But it has gone up immensely. We are not being asked to do more with less. We are being asked to do more with less money than we expected. If you have any doubt of the enviable circumstance that we are in, call one of your peers. Call someone else around the country in any one of the 43 states or 44 states that are looking at amazing budget cuts. I emphasize this in part to you, but in part to the citizens of the state, to understand that there is not funding available, but there are not needs that have been left unaddressed. We may not be able to fund every request, and I know from my correspondence, since I did my recommendations, that there are significant reservations about our failure to fund some of these requests. But I urge you to be careful. And it's not that we're broke. There's funding out there. I mean, we can eventually, if we have to, we can change the diversion of the additional 1% of the severance tax to the permanent mental trust fund. We don't need to do that. We shouldn't do it, and we can contemplate it. And they've done it in the past. There are revenues available. The fact that those revenues are available does not mean that they need to be spent. So what was the guiding light on my recommendations? I emphasized finishing the capital construction, staying on that course. Money for highways, airports, and some things that impact the economy to make sure that we create jobs. It is my view that that capital construction funded by the state, scattered around the state, creates jobs, stimulates the local economy, and adds revenues. There's also within this budget $900,000 that is designed to do very targeted advertising to help maintain some semblance of normality in the tourism sector. The tourism sector is not only important for that sector itself, but it is important because it may be the one source of additional retail expenditures for many of the stores, cafes, and other operations in Wyoming. So I encourage you to look upon that as an asset to the economy. Second thing, I think we need to address some accrued obligations. And one of those obligations is the actuarial shortfall in the retirement account as it relates to accommodating the significant increase we made in teacher salaries. Really pretty simple. Teachers paid in for many, many years at one salary rate. They eventually retire at a salary rate that is based on the increase in salaries that we have offered and put into the system over the last few years, because their retirement is based on their highest 3 years of salary. That has created an actuarial shortfall in the retirement account in being able to maintain the defined benefits for the educational community. I've allocated $150 million to go into the auditor's office to be available, to make sure that we can eventually fund that. I do not support putting that money into the retirement account today, because I think that based on the audit that was prepared, we need to examine the accuracy of those numbers and to make sure that it is correct. The other thing I said about doing was trying to move forward the agenda on some things that we'd already started. Most notable in that is the opening of the new facility at Torrington. Many years ago, we collectively made a decision that we would rather house prisoners in the state than out of the state. Decision was made to build a prison at Rawlins, or at Torrington. I know they wanted it at Rawlins, we built it at Torrington. But it was built at Torrington, and we're now at that stage where we need to open it, make use of it, and bring the prisoners back to the state. I know that it is a significant impact on the budget. It's 158 employees, 158 added employees associated with the opening of the facility in Torrington. I also included in the budget not a great deal of funding for local governments, but there is one fund that we need to complete, and that is some money for Wamsutter. It's $3.5 million. The reason that it's in the budget is that we have a corporate match for those funds available to us if we follow through. We made a commitment that we would try to fund that. It's an area that needs the assistance, and I would encourage you to do it. I also have funded a recommended funding for the Gillette Water Project. I did that not because the president of the Senate is from Gillette, but because it's a project I've supported for some time. It's a relatively modest amount, around $11 million, but it is enough to keep that project moving forward, and hopefully that'll happen. But the other thing I had to do in this budget was forego some things that are near and dear to me. I took all of the funding out of the Wildlife Trust Fund. I took the funding out of the Library Trust. I took the funding out of and removed the funding that was recommended for the Cultural Trust Fund. It seemed to me that I can't stand in front of you and ask you to forego your particular spending proposal if I don't demonstrate some restraint on my part. Those are projects that are near and dear to me, but they simply are not within the reach of the budget. But let me illustrate generally what the budget looks like, and I'll do it using the military department. In the context of the military department, there were some things I funded and there were some things I didn't. I asked for an additional $1 million for the effort that has been underway for many years for us to have funds available to assist the families of the deployed soldiers. That $1 million calculation is based on the fact that come a couple of months from now, we will have the single greatest deployment of Army Guardsmen that's ever occurred in this state's history. We will have approximately 950 soldiers who will be deployed, and once they are deployed, their family members may have some needs that we should meet. Now, within that context, I did the $1 million as new funding. Arguably, you could have taken that out of the corpus of the Military Trust Fund. I would argue that we leave that corpus alone and that we fund this out of current revenues. I also funded vault and casket handling equipment. Now, you can say, you can look at that line item and say, you know, we really don't have to do that. And in that sense, you're correct. We could continue a practice in which caskets of our veterans are moved about by a backhoe. I find that completely unacceptable, and I've asked for funding to make sure that we handle that the way that it should be done, not the way that we're doing it today. And lastly, I've asked for funding for a World War II memorial in Cody. Again, you can say, don't have to do it. The world won't end if we don't. But Wyoming's a better place if we do. And why are we doing it? Two reasons. One is, based on some data, not this year, but within the last few years, Wyoming has the highest per capita number of World War II veterans of any state in the United States. We are losing our World War II veterans at an astounding rate, and I believe that we should build a memorial, place it in Cody, and have it done while it is still meaningful to the remainder of those veterans. The issue with regard to the military deployed, the families of the military deployed, we need to understand that Wyoming is probably, we're either first or second on a per capita basis of the number of people who sign up and go to military service in the country. Arguably, you could say we're fourth, depending on how you like the data, but since I'm governor of the state, the data is going to say what I want it to say. But it's important that we recognize the contribution that these men and women make and the contribution that their families make by living through the deployments, and I encourage you to support it. In that context, we're joined today by some representatives, four, who I would like to introduce of the military. One is Major General Ed Wright, the Adjutant General. We have Colonel Rich Knowlton, Commander of the 115th Fire Brigade, Commander Sergeant Major Kenton Franklin of the 115th Fire Brigade, Colonel Dennis Grunstad, the new commander of the 153rd Air Wing, and Chief Master Sergeant Tom Lofton. Ladies and gentlemen, these represent wonderful soldiers. I know that the military department sends out notices to each of you to give you the time and date and location of the deployments. I would encourage any of you who are able to participate. It is my experience that they are okay if we're there at the deployment. When you return, it's okay if you're there, but they don't want to spend a lot of time with you. They'd rather be with your family. But I think that if we can show that kind of support, we should continue to do it. In the context of restricted budget, I will tell you there are only two legislative measures at this point, because I haven't seen everything that's been introduced, but there are only two legislative measures with funding that I am supporting. And those two measures are the First Children's Finance Program and the Health Care Reform Pilot Project. I have identified sources within the current funding stream that I can offer up in order to fund those, and am not asking for additional general fund consideration. I hope that this body will give each of them serious deliberation. The First Children's Finance Program is our continuing effort to try to address the lack of available child care in Wyoming. I know that you hear from your constituents, just as I do, that one of the most serious issues in the state is the absence of available child care, and I believe this is a constructive way to address part of that problem. The Health Care Reform Pilot is a much improved version of a bill that made it from the Senate over to the House and didn't quite make it out last session. It is much improved in two ways. I think it is a clear statement with regard to the responsibilities of the individual and the role of the state and the role of the employer, but it is also substantially less expensive than the last time we offered it through. I understand the reticence that people have with regard to trying to do anything in the healthcare area. We have watched states throughout this country who have adopted health care programs on a broad base and have found themselves financially unable to fund it. This is why I support a fairly narrow pilot which emphasizes individual responsibility for their health, emphasizes additional time with the patient from the primary care physician, tries to make that a financially workable circumstance, and is intended to bridge that gap so that people can eventually move to a private insurance market. Understanding that I'm not sure whether this will work, I believe it works, it has the correct principles, I encourage you to adopt the pilot. If the pilot works, it has some potential going forward to help us address issues of insurance availability and also to help us address the general cost of healthcare. I have become convinced that the only way we're going to actually address the spiraling cost of health care is to begin to place more responsibility for the management of our health on us as individuals. We have a history in this country of essentially saying, I don't worry about my health, I don't worry about what I eat, I don't worry about what I smoke, and as soon as I get unhealthy, I will go to the doctor and he will cure me. There's two things wrong with that. One is it doesn't work because not everything is curable. And secondly, it is a huge expense. And I believe that one of the things that we have to do, not just in this state, but in this country, is to figure out a way for us to deal with the demand side of health care and begin to take more responsibility for our own health. Some bills that do not have general fund impact that I would commend to you are the four carbon sequestration bills. This state has established itself in a leadership role with regard to carbon sequestration. These bills will move us further in that direction. Is it perfect? Probably not. We may be back over the years asking for additional changes. But it is important, particularly as we move forward into a carbon-constrained world, that Wyoming take a leadership role in making sure that carbon capture and sequestration can be done. Workers' comp. Workers' comp has been looked at by the interim committee. I'm generally comfortable with the bill. There are a couple of things in the bill, as well as a couple other measures floating around with which I do not have quite the high degree of comfort. I'm concerned that we make sure that any cost of living increases that we integrate into this process have a cap, that it is one that is identifiable, that we make it a circumstance where we can make them actuarially calculable. Secondly, I am concerned about the proposition that we would open up this workers' comp program too broadly with regard to mental health and mental illness. If we decide to go on that course, I encourage you to make it as narrow as possible. Let's start gently into that area to make sure that we have some sense of the actuarial implications to the employers in this state. And people suggest to you that really it's just the workers' comp fund. It's not real money. We can just take it. Remember that the source of all of those dollars are the employers in this state. And I encourage you to be thoughtful and narrow. I do support changing the death benefits and some of the other things. We, frankly, should be embarrassed at the current levels. They haven't been looked at in 25 years, and I think it is time that we increase those. But I urge you some caution with regard to the other measures. I also support what is called the court-ordered treatment bill. I bring it up because this may be the first time since I've been here that the Chief Justice will not get up right after me and say, we don't support it. In that context, we've previously talked about problem-solving courts and drug courts, and usually I get up and make the pitch. Chief Justice gets up and says, we don't support it, and it dies. This time, we bring to you a compromise bill, frankly, largely drafted, and I want to commend Chief Justice Voigt for his efforts, a compromise bill that I believe addresses people's concerns, but also recognizes that we have a set of courts out there, and we need a structure in which they're going to operate. I encourage you to take a serious look at that. I would also ask that you consider removing the sales and use tax exemption on wind energy projects. I have heard from any number of county commissioners that they are dealing with the impact of the development of wind energy, and they have no revenue. I acknowledge that it's appropriate for me to ask because I asked you to put the exemption in the first place. And we did that because we wanted to signal that Wyoming is ready for business, particularly with regard to wind energy. I would say that we have succeeded. More importantly, the driving force behind the development of wind energy is not an exemption from the state's sales and use tax policy. It is a federal production tax credit. And the federal production tax credit is the incentive that causes it to be created. There is little or no revenue that accrues to the counties and the jurisdictions where they are located, and I believe it is appropriate at this time, recognizing the underlying strength of that industry as afforded by the federal production tax credit, that the state end its indirect subsidy of that business, and we allow that business to prosper as it will, unaided by the state's tax policy. A couple other issues I want to talk about. There's some stuff running around here about gambling again. I wanted you to know that I haven't changed my position on it. I don't support it. I have said, and I stand by my commitment, that if I get a nice, regular Powerball bill, I've said I would support that. If it has some of the additions with regard to Insta Race and some of the other items that I think move us much closer to gaming as opposed to Powerball. I hope that you will not send that bill to me. I've read the Constitution. I know what I can say and what I can't say. I also am mindful that there will be another proposal brought to you. I believe it will originate in the House, that we again give the voters a chance to take a look at a tort reform amendment. I would encourage you to debate that and pass it to the voters and let them take another look at it in 2010. The issue, I know, has been before the voters before. I believe that it remains an issue for which this state still continues to search for a solution, and I believe that we should give the voters the opportunity to pursue that measure and decide whether they want to adopt it or not. It is a slightly modified measure from the measure that was offered to the voters before, and I would commend it to your deliberations. There are also a series of bills that I view as simply telling people how to run their lives and how to run their businesses. I would encourage you to be cautious. The fact that the government may have power over people and over their businesses doesn't mean that we need to exercise it. Sometimes the best use of power is to leave it unused. I would commend to you the thoughts of Barry Goldwater. Mindful that the majority of you are of his persuasion, I have decided that I will speak to you from the book of Goldwater. Goldwater spoke of traditional conservatism and said the following: "The positive role of limited government has always been the defense of these fundamental principles. The conservative movement is founded on the simple tenet that people have the right to live life as they please, as long as they don't hurt anyone else in the process." It was good wisdom then, and it's good wisdom now. When I look at some of the proposals, I hope that you have other things to occupy your time. I want to commend the Senate President for some things he said yesterday that I read in the paper, asking some fairly serious questions about education, about juveniles, and about some of the programs we're doing. The question of juveniles is one that we will continue to address over the next few years. I would encourage you to create an interim committee which will look at this question of facilities, but needs to look at it more broadly. When it comes to juveniles, there are four things that we need to think about. We need a single point of entry to the criminal justice system for all youth that are charged. Right now, we have multiple courts, multiple systems, multiple entry points. We need an immediate and comprehensive assessment tool, some form of a tool that assesses what is the right disposition of this juvenile in the circumstance that they're under. We need a community-based system of care, and that includes diversion, and it also runs the gamut to secure detention. Having once assessed what's the proper outcome for a youth, we need to make sure that we have the facilities available going forward. And then we need a data collection system. This question about the data with regard to juveniles, again, suffers from disparate data sources, the difficulty in comparing them, and how do we act on the information to develop policy. I hope that you will take this opportunity to have some form of an interim committee, hopefully a standing committee, take a look at this issue going forward. So if we don't have a lot of money to spend, we have a relatively limited number of bills, although I see they're increasing, what is it that we should do with our time as we spend these 40 days together? There are a number of these proposals that are good proposals. They're just not going to be able to get funded. We just can't afford it, and we shouldn't afford it. And we have time, though, over this time in the session, as well as going forward, to refine those proposals. Think about them with a little more care. It doesn't hurt to follow the old carpenter's rule about measure twice and cut once. I think it applies to legislation as well as anything else. So let's use that time. And as you do that, please think about what it is we're trying to accomplish with a given piece of legislation. There's this sort of notion that somehow if you don't pass something, you've failed as a legislator. I will tell you that I've come to the view in my old age that maybe the best legislators don't pass anything. I mean, the stuff that's in the statute books is confusing enough as it is. It wouldn't hurt us to repeal a few and pass a lot fewer. Think about what it is you're trying to get done, and more importantly, think about what is this that you're trying, this evil that you say you're out to remedy. We have chosen to turn everything into a felony. I notice in the proposed immigration bill that harboring, we're going to turn it into a state felony. What that means is county attorneys will have more cases to prosecute, the Torrington prison will fill up faster, and the only burden that we're meeting is a burden that legitimately belongs with the federal government. The absence of the federal government solving the problem doesn't mean that we ought to step up and spend a lot of state money addressing one more federal issue that they haven't handled. We do enough of that. Maybe there's another way to address the issue. I'm comfortable on immigration when we say we don't want illegal immigrants taking advantage of state assistance. When we begin to move the next step, which is to fill the void left by the federal government, I get nervous because it's going to cost us money. And for one thing, it seems to me that we ought to calculate that out before we start down that road. I would also encourage you in this process to look at what I call the inherent budget drivers. We have within this system, and each of the jurisdictional committees could take a look at it, we have within this system a series of statutory language that forces expansions in the budget. One of the areas in which that occurs most often is in the health department. An immense number of programs over there in which we say we'll adjust it every 2 years or we'll adjust it every 3 years. We are getting ourselves into the position where we have obligated ourselves to fund things, and we've lost the control that the legislature keeps telling me they want of the purse. For instance, when I came in, I wanted to do away with the legislative earmarks, or to reestablish legislative earmarks so that local governments could get more money. I was told that no, legislature does not want to reestablish earmarks because we want to control the appropriations. So you've gained control of the revenue stream coming in, but you have lost control of the revenue stream going out by virtue of the number of statutory formulas that now become automatic inclusions in the executive branch budget. We have this lull in revenues. Let's take advantage of that to try to figure out whether we're doing the system correctly. The fact that we don't have more money doesn't mean that we shouldn't be thinking about, are we spending the money we're currently spending properly, and are we doing it in a way that is rational? Perhaps the largest area in which that occurs is K-12 funding. I realize that I am not the constitutional officer charged with the supervision of education. That properly belongs under Article 7, Section 14, with the Superintendent of Public Instruction. But I will tell you, in my role of Chief Budget Officer, I have been responsible, along with you, with finding the money and increasing the funding. And we have done that. Wyoming ranks first or second in nearly all of those ratings in terms of the funding effort. And then it falls off. Whether it's test scores or matriculation or it's dropout rate, we are in a position where the only A we get on the report card is for funding. And then after that, it drops off, and it drops off dramatically. The driver of that is the school funding formula, where we have picked up a wide variety of things that people hoped would work and would be part of the funding formula and would be part of the school system. We have the opportunity now to go back and look. Are we making the right investment? It is not my intent to supersede the authority of the Superintendent of Public Instruction, but to, and we've spoken of this, but to try to work with him to begin to ask these questions in a systematic way. The best statement of policy about what it is this state wants to accomplish with K-12 education is found in the statutes for the State Board of Education. In essence, it says the state, its goal is to provide students an opportunity to acquire sufficient knowledge and skills, at a minimum, to enter the University of Wyoming and Wyoming Community Colleges, to prepare students for the job market or post-secondary vocational and technical training, and to achieve the general purposes of education, of an education that equips students for their role as citizens and as participants in the political system, and to have the opportunity to compete both intellectually and economically in the society. I believe that we are placing funding at a high enough level that that goal should be achievable. I encourage you, particularly the Joint Education Committee, to adopt a working ethic along with the superintendent that we begin to try to figure out how it is that we are spending money at a level that gets us an A on the report card and all the rest of the grades are not grades that we would want to take home to show to our parents. It seems to me that we have questions that need to be asked, and they need to be asked now before we move into the recalibration of the school financing formula. Having painted that rather grim picture, I want to tell you about a part of the budget that I'm most enthusiastic about and hope that it will remain where it is. As you know, thanks to Senator Enzi, we have been able to obtain a significant amount of abandoned mine land funds that the state has been due for decades, and we have now begun to receive those. We began with that program by isolating those funds and dedicating them to building the energy and environmental future of this state. It's funded coal gasification and clean coal technology research. It's looking at the carbon capture and sequestration. There's a big chunk in that budget to finish out our partnership for the coal gasification facility that is being done in conjunction with the university and a major industry. There's a chunk of that budget which is dedicated to trying to understand what it is that is creating the air quality issues with regard to air ozone in southwestern Wyoming. I encourage you to leave that funding there. If we do not sort out this ozone question and get a better understanding of what is going on, our ability to continue to produce natural gas at the rate that it is being produced there will be severely restricted. I encourage you to remain committed to a budget that invests in the future of Wyoming and particularly in its energy and environment future. I emphasize that because I, like a number of you, have been approached by people saying, look, let's not do that this year. This year, let's take the AML money and spend it on and then fill in the blank, whether it's the water project in Gillette or social services or something else. There's a lot of pressure to take what is fundamentally our key investment in the energy and environment future of this state and use it for other purposes. Please, please, with all deference to the other needs of the present, let us remain committed to a course that invests funding in the future of the state. You know, the circumstance we find ourselves in is one of uncertainty, one of serious challenge. And so I go looking for places, where do we find advice? You all know Albert Einstein, one of the greatest minds to ever grace the world. A mind of his quality came up with a very simple set of advice, which he sent to his son in a letter. He says, life is like riding a bicycle. To keep your balance, you must keep moving. For Wyoming, for us to keep our balance, we must keep moving. There's a tendency in times of uncertainty, in times in which we're not quite clear what the future is going to bring, to recede into an area of comfort and inaction. I would argue that there's nothing worse we could do for the citizens of the state. A more Western way to say what Einstein had to say is that it's time for us to ride out the storm. Those of you who've been out moving livestock know what I'm talking about. You're out there and you've got a job to do, and here comes a summer storm. It's not time then to forget the livestock and head to the barn. It's time to ride out the storm, get the job done, and finish your task. And we are indeed in a storm that's going to affect this state and this country, those that we love and those that we don't know. And the only thing we can do is to stay focused, stick with the underlying agenda, limit our expenditures, take advantage of the opportunity to review how we're spending money, and become much more focused about the future. It's important because, as Senator Joseph Kerry said, each generation should be willing to leave after it more than it finds at its beginning. There would be little left in the world for any of us if the policy had been for one age to exhaust and destroy and leave but little to the succeeding one. We owe it to the present, we owe it to the future, to heed the admonition that our greatest obligation is to leave more behind after we have been here than was here when we arrived. Ladies and gentlemen, I look forward to working with you. I look forward to hearing from the citizens of the state about the budget. God bless you and Godspeed. Thank you.
Governor Freudenthal, on behalf of the members of the legislature, I thank you for attending this session and for your message to us. Members of the 60th legislature, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, I now present the Honorable Orton Voigt, Chief Justice of the Wyoming Supreme Court.
Speaker, Mr. President, Governor and Mrs. Freudenthal, members of the 60th Wyoming Legislature, elected officials, fellow judges, friends, fellow citizens, I'm pleased to appear before you now for my third report on the state of the Wyoming judiciary. The phrase, three strikes and you're out, came to me, but I also remembered that you can't hit what you don't swing at, so here goes. I do have to ad lib right off the bat, which I try not to do, but Governor, it occurred to me, when I look at these speakers, they think that either you or I speak out of both sides of our mouth, apparently. And I was hoping they'd take one of them down when I got up here, but they didn't, so I don't know what that means. 2 years ago, my remarks covered 24 pages, double-spaced. Last year, it was 31 pages. So my goal this year was 38 pages of absolutely essential information, crucial to your understanding of the operation of the judicial branch of government. Luckily for you, my wife tells me that I'm getting considerably less interesting with age and that I really ought to say as little as possible here today, so I will try to adhere to that advice, and it's actually shorter. The biggest news, at least for us in the Supreme Court, is that we are back home on the correct side of Capitol Avenue after 2 years in exile. Many of you have been through our building already. I'm sure you agree that it is now a treasure for the people of the state of Wyoming. And this body really should congratulate itself for the foresight that it showed in fixing that building when it needed to be done. You know, every 80 years or so, you got to put some maintenance money in there. But not only was it remodeled, but you'll see if you come this afternoon that its utility has been enhanced, and it's a much more usable building for us. That building is the representation of the judicial branch of this government. That building deserves the same respect and admiration from you and me and the public that this building does, and we appreciate all of you coming over to help us celebrate that this afternoon. As you know, that's at 4:30 for a special session. It will be brief, and we'll give you an opportunity to take a tour of the building at that time. Going on to something else, I have always believed, and I think that most judges and political scientists agree, that the judiciary in America's system of government is meant to be the most conservative branch. And by that I mean that the judiciary is supposed to be the furthest removed from the whims, fancies, and fads of the day, with the law developing slowly and surely over time, rather than in knee-jerk reaction to changing events. Now, unfortunately, that precept also controlled our approach to procedure and media methodology for a long time, how we do what we do. That is why you will find more leather-bound ledger books and quill pens in courthouses than anywhere else in America. Now, I make that point to emphasize how amazed I have been that my entire tenure so far as Chief Justice has been marked by an almost constant attention to technology. Computers, servers, electronic case management systems, electronic filing, electronic citations, digital courtroom recording, real-time courtroom reporting, wireless internet service, video appearances. The list goes on and on. Every day there's something new for us to worry about. Now, in that regard, I will just in passing ask you to give favorable attention to our supplemental budget request this session. There are three items, at least at this point, in that request, all involving computer technology. First is a joint project with the Wyoming Highway Patrol for electronic issuance of citations, which project will lead to electronic filing in the circuit courts, along with simultaneously populating all of the internal Highway Patrol reports that they have to do. That would then also help control the information shared between the court and the state law enforcement. Now, the second thing that we have in our budget is a system that would help the Supreme Court and the State Bar coordinate all of the bar information and activities. And the third item in our budget request is the uniform electronic case management in the district courts. We've talked about that before, that we have elected district court clerks. We have separately elected district court judges. We have, I don't know the exact number, 6 or 7 different types of case management systems in the district courts, which is quite problematic. Now, we presented that budget to the Joint Appropriations Committee, and ironically, I was unable to attend that presentation because I was participating in a national seminar on electronic filing. The primary lesson that I learned at that seminar is that we may think that we are leading the pack in this regard, but in truth, we are way behind the rest of the world, and we are barely keeping up. The citizens of Wyoming deserve, and the citizens will demand, that this government function like any modern business, that we are finally figuring out how efficient electronic communication is in making sure that law enforcement officers have immediate access to court information. For instance, a deputy sheriff in Casper should be able to determine instantaneously whether an alleged Campbell County domestic violence order does or does not exist, whether it has been served or not. So our rapid technological developments required us to bring these things before you this session rather than to wait another year to come back, because all this stuff is ongoing. Before I leave the topic of technology, I should tell you two additional things. First, the electronic docketing, case management, and e-filing system that you funded for the Supreme Court is completely up and functional at all three levels. You should visit our website to see how it operates, or when you come over this afternoon, talk to one of the clerks of court or talk to one of the folks in our IT staff, and they'll be glad to show all of it to you. It's actually a wonder. Especially with the website, the operation of the Wyoming Supreme Court and our other courts is simply much more visible and obtainable. The information is much more obtainable than it ever was in the past. The second thing that I feel compelled to tell you about court technology has to do with our staff. Stephen Dreer, James Bothamley, Frosty Sprout, Sergio Gonzalez, John Capron, Doug Schmidt, and Jennifer Petrella. We ourselves never had any doubt that their expertise was the primary reason or factor in our technological successes. We're very happy with the overwhelmingly positive response that we have received from the district courts and the circuit courts when they go out and help them do things. Our confidence in them was recently reinforced when the vice president of LT Court Tech, and that is the nationally experienced company that installed our electronic case management system, Manoj Jain is his name, and Manoj told me that he believed our staff to be the best court technology staff in the nation. Now, since I'm supposed to be kind of bringing you up to date on what's going on in the judiciary, I'll get out of the technology area for a while, and I'll just give you a few statistics. Won't bore you with details, but I thought you might just want to hear a bit about filing trends. In fiscal year 2007, there were 173,937 cases filed in the circuit courts. Most of those cases were, as usual, traffic citations. That number grew to 175,651 in 2008. In fiscal year 2007, there were 18,514 cases filed in the district courts. That number dropped to 17,444 in 2008. In calendar year 2007, 299 appeals were filed in the Supreme Court, That number dropped to 281 in calendar year 2008. We have not explored the reasons for these minor changes, both up and down. We do not consider any of them to be of major statistical significance at this point, in the sense of showing a general trend in any particular direction. I would say that what these statistics do show us, when we study them in detail, county by county and district by district, is that the system is generally in balance. And by that I mean that there is a pretty good correlation between the number of judges needed and the number of judges available. As I have mentioned before, however, there are some areas of concern that we will continue to study to make sure that all of Wyoming's citizens have equal access to the courtroom. Sweetwater County is probably at the top of that list, with a shortage of coverage in both the district court and the circuit court. And we are waiting there for some local facilities decisions before we decide what to do next. I should mention also that we, and by we I mean the Supreme Court and the Board of Judicial Policy and Administration, strive to make sure that judicial resources in Wyoming remain in balance. We continually monitor caseload statistics and docketing delays to ensure that the judicial process works as well as possible. In the trial courts, this is accomplished mainly in an informal fashion, with judges covering for each other upon a simple phone request to keep the more crowded dockets moving as rapidly as possible. District judges routinely handle cases. They cross over outside their district. They handle lengthy jury trials, for instance, to allow the local judge the opportunity to catch up on bench trials and motion hearings. Now, I've been either a judge or a justice for the past 20 years, and I'm not exaggerating when I tell you that the district judges' conference and the circuit judges' conference are policing themselves, if you will, better right now than at any other time during that period that I can think of. Both conferences have regular meetings, arrange for specialized training, discuss common problems, and work towards standard procedures. There was a time when Wyoming trial judges were an empire unto themselves, and I'm glad to say those days are over. While I am discussing the trial courts, I will mention the changes on the bench since last session. Michael Davis replaced Nick Calacasas as a district judge here in Cheyenne. Bob Scar replaced Gary Hartman as the district judge in Warland. Tom Harrington, in turn, replaced Bob Scar as the circuit judge in Warland. And finally, Marv Tyler was appointed to fill the newly created district court position in Pinedale. We welcome all these judges to the fold, and we wish them the best. One other thing I want to tell you about that, giving credit where credit is due, you may not know that the governor attends each and every one of those robing ceremonies, speaks at those ceremonies, and the judges and I believe the citizens, the public who shows up, very much appreciate that effort and the recognition that the governor gives to those situations. And we thank you for that. A couple more specific activities, if you will. We continue actively to pursue the concept of court security through a variety of avenues. First and foremost, we have hired Kevin White, a former legislator most of you probably know, as our court security officer. His primary focus will be building and personal security here at the Supreme Court, but he also will spearhead our statewide court security efforts. The Court Security Commission that was created a year ago about also continues to meet regularly for the purpose of developing a rational approach to courthouse security. We have many and varied county courthouses across this state. In June, we brought in staff members from the National Center for State Courts to give security seminars for judges, court clerks, and security officers, with six separate sessions, two each in Rock Springs, Casper, and Cheyenne. We trained over 200 court personnel. Our goal is to develop emergency response plans for all county courthouses and to implement whatever recommendations are made by the Court Security Commission. This planning will incorporate the concept of continuation of business in the event of a disaster. For instance, how will a local district court and circuit court continue operation if a courthouse happens to burn down? We do not have a ready answer to that question. I might add, although the fact that we have centrally located all the electronic data within our facility is going to help in that regard. Finally, as to security, I want to thank Colonel Powell and the Highway Patrol Capital Security Division for their fine cooperation in getting Kevin commissioned and providing additional security during special court sessions. I'm sure you will see some of them over at the courthouse this afternoon. In another initiative, our administrative and IT staffs worked with the Secretary of State's office and the Department of Motor Vehicles to revise the method by which master jury lists, which lists are used both in the district and circuit courts, are created. The master jury lists are a combination of voter registration and driver license lists. The replacement of the software utilized by the Secretary of State's office necessitated this change. And I think this interbranch cooperation was a fine example of how public servants should react quickly and do what is necessary to solve problems for the benefits of the populace. Briefly, I will also mention that we're working on a branch-wide policy governing access to court records. Lately, largely due to the proliferation of the computer world and the World Wide Web, we have received an increasing number of requests for the mass production of records. Literally, requests such as, I want a copy of all your circuit court records, or I want a copy of all your civil judgment records. Now, we believe that court records presumptively should be open and available to the public, but we need policies recognizing what is and what is not confidential, as well as how and when access may be obtained. As to confidential information, such as Social Security numbers, financial account numbers, birth dates, addresses, and the like, we have concluded that something we might call preemptive redaction will be the best approach. In other words, keep that information out of court documents to begin with, rather than later trying to redact it piece by piece before the documents are given out. On another point, about a month ago, the Board of Judicial Policy Administration asked the Supreme Court to create a commission to deal with the problem of access to justice in Wyoming. The corporation that had been receiving federal funds to provide civil representation to indigents folded, leaving a huge hole in the availability of such services. A temporary fix is in place, but a long-term resolution is needed. That commission has been created, and it may also look into other issues that impact the ability of Wyoming citizens to get into the courtroom, such as delayed docketing and case management problems. We also continue to deal with the perennial issue of the extent to which municipal courts can and should be drawn into the state court system. Much of the law enforcement in this state takes place in municipal courts, yet the municipalities are not part of the state system in many ways. We hope in the future to work more closely with mayors, town council, chiefs of police, town attorneys to create more cooperation, uniformity, and sharing of information. We are, for instance, looking at the possibility of a uniform municipal criminal code that would sort of look like the Wyoming criminal code statutes, but this would be a town code, the purpose of which would be to enhance the sharing of data among law enforcement agencies via our judicial branch database. I should not conclude these remarks without mentioning the two aspects of our work that continue to seem to draw the most attention in the media. Those two areas are juvenile courts and court-based drug treatment programs. There appears to be a widely held belief that our juvenile courts, which means our district judges sitting in juvenile court, are failing adequately to deliver juvenile justice. I believe you will find that almost universally, the prosecutors and the district judges do not agree with that assessment. They will tell you that the allegation that the right hand, the juvenile courts, do not know what the left hand, the circuit and municipal courts, are doing is simply not true. In addition, they will tell you that the answer to the problem of providing services to juveniles is not restructuring the juvenile court system, but ensuring the availability of services within the community. As to court-based drug treatment programs, or drug courts as some like to call them, the governor has mentioned this to you. It will come before you this session, an attempt to form a compromise bill. And by compromise, I mean there are some people out there who very much believe in the concept of drug courts and what they do. There are a lot of folks out there, including many judges, who think they're unconstitutional and they violate separation of powers and they violate the code of ethics. We're making an attempt to get this off the table, if you will, and reach a consensus that will allow the programs to continue to exist at the same time that we answer some of those constitutional problems. So that's something you'll be studying this session. That about covers the main things I wanted to tell you. The governor and I don't do things quite the same way, and his version of how you should do things and where you should go is much broader than mine because of the things that he has to look at. As I get older, I find myself more interested simply in meddling in other people's affairs. So it occurred to me that I could use this opportunity in closing to just sort of talk to you, to tell you, when you're talking to other legislators and you're trying, say, to sell them on a bill, I think I can give you some advice. I used to tell, and I guess I still do sometimes, law students and young lawyers, when they want to know how to deal with a panel of jurors, how do you go about doing that? Well, it occurred to me that that's pretty much the same thing here. How do you go about dealing with one another? If you look at the rest of your colleagues, it's like a big panel of jurors, and you have to figure out what it is that they're doing and thinking. So what I tell young lawyers all the time, and the thing that I use is the old story about why did the chicken cross the road? The reason I bring this up, I've only got a couple of the examples. I have many more than this. You need to remember that each one of your peers out there looks at something from a completely different perspective than you do and is looking through his or her own particular prism. So if you just, instead of thinking about talking about selling your bill, if you think to yourself that you come up to one of your fellows and ask them why the chicken crossed the road, this is what you look at. If you ask that question of your fellow legislator and he or she happens to be a kindergarten teacher, he or she will tell you that the chicken crossed the road to get to the other side. But if you ask another legislator, let's say, for instance, that Captain James T. Kirk is in the legislature, he would probably tell you that the chicken crossed the road to boldly go where no chicken has gone before. If you have Bill Gates here in the legislature, as soon as you start talking about it, he'll ignore you and start thinking to himself, you know, I could release a software program called Chicken 2009, which will not only cross roads, but it will lay eggs, file your important documents, and balance your checkbook. I know for sure that any legislator over 50 years of age will respond by saying, in my day, we didn't ask why the chicken crossed the road. If someone told us the chicken crossed the road, that was good enough for us. That's what's going to happen to you when you bring a perfectly understandable bill to your fellows and they look blankly at you. So be careful out there, my friends. Don't make any assumptions about your fellows. Google them if you have to. And I think you'll get through it. At any rate, that's basically where we are in the judiciary, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you. Thank you.
Chief Justice Boyd, on behalf of the members of the legislature, I thank you for attending this joint session and for your message. Senator Ross and Representative Buchanan and Myers, will you please escort the First Lady of Wyoming and the Governor from the chamber? Senator DiCara and Representative Philp and Goggles, will you please escort the Chief Justice from the chamber? other guests are excused to exit the chamber at this time. Thank you. Mr. Speaker, thanks to you and to the member of the House of Representatives for being our host this morning. Senate Majority Floor Leader Anderson.
Mr. President, I move that this joint session be dissolved.
Senate Minority Leader, session.
Mr. President, I second that motion.
All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion carried. Senate Majority Floor Leader Anderson.
Mr. President, I move that the Senate be in recess until 2 p.m.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
The Senate is recessed until 2 p.m.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader Buchanan.
Mr. Speaker, I move that the House be in recess until 2 p.m.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
The House is recessed until 2 p.m. Thank you.